This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Kermode back, refreshed from his long vacation. Mark, good afternoon.
Yeah, as opposed to the long vacation that you're taking in Beijing, Simon, how is it for you?
This is not
a
vacation.
It's hard work.
It's hard work. It's a privilege to be here, of course. It's hard work. And if only you were here applauding the athletes over the finishing line with that unique look of sporting confusion that you have over your features at moments like this.
How are the games going? Are we doing well?
Well, we won a gold medal this afternoon, actually, in the cycling. So I'd have to say, although it's been a little disappointing from a British point of view in the stadium here today, it's going pretty well, and we're expecting an avalanche of medals over the weekend.
Excellent.
Let's do the box office top 10. So I hope you've seen all these. I know you've been
on holiday. Some of them I will, and some of them I won't. I'm sorry. There we go. I've been on holiday.
Now, at number 10, The X-Files, I Want to Believe.
And this is a big problem for me, because I went to see The X-Files movie. I was a big fan of The X-Files ages and ages ago, and it's been 10 years since the last X-Files movie. And I interviewed David Duchovny when the last X-Files movie came out. And the whole point about The X-Files is that there's the whole thing about Gillian Anton and David Duchovny, Mulder and Scully, that they never actually get it together. And there's a moment in the last X-Files movie in which he does kiss her, but it's the kiss of life, and so it doesn't count. And I said to David Duchovny, I love that bit in the film because they kiss, but they don't. And he said, that's the whole thing about The X-Files, isn't it? And then we get to this new X-Files movie. They've got a kid. They've had some kid. It's been given up for adoption or abduction or whatever it is, and they've had some whole relationship, and
there's quite a difference between adoption, which is a fairly standard practice,
and abduction. Not in the X-Files, because you have to. What happens is that Gillian Anderson, apparently, I missed all this in the series, that Gillian Anderson's character has a child, and she doesn't say who the father is, because by that point, he's been abducted by aliens, because, his sister was abducted by aliens. And then she gives the child up. Yeah, exactly. And I'm sitting there going, so they've got it together. They're now in love with each other. They're living in the same house. They say, I love you. And they have a child who they have given up for adoption. And why am I interested in The X-Files anymore? Because the whole point about The X-Files is that Mulder and Scully don't get together. So there's a movie in which says, Billy Connolly and a whole bunch of other sort of weird casting. But I just spent the whole movie I cannot get my hat on about the fact that there is an X-Files movie in which they are a couple. It doesn't work. The X-Files
Space
doesn't work if they're a couple.
Space Chimps at 9.
I haven't seen it. Animated Chimps in Space, which apparently underperformed at the box office. Who could possibly believe that such a thing would be true?
Kung Fu Panda at number 8.
Which I have seen, and I kind of like it's all right. I mean, there's nothing enormously exciting about it, except if you see it in the IMAX cinema, it's very, very big. But it's, it's knockabout and jolly and lively and unlikely to offend anybody whatsoever. And we've got to the point with the standard of kids' movies nowadays being so, generally poor, that Kung Fu Panda is holding up as a holiday favourite.
There was a Chinese movie director who was quoted in one of the papers as sort of questioning as to why didn't the Chinese make Kung Fu Panda? Why haven't they got the creativity to be making it?
It wasn't Yang Zimu who said that, was it?
Sure.
Because I think he was brought in to orchestrate the opening of the Olympics, and he's the go-to director that they get. So it may well have been.
What did you make of Curse of the Golden Flower? Do you like that?
Remind me of Curse of the Golden Flower.
It was one of his more sumptuous Tang Dynasty epics.
Hey, you're reading this off a computer, aren't you?
There was a gargantuan. You remember the gargantuan gold-laced imperial palace? It was created with a cast of thousands, bright colours. No,
you are definitely reading that off the IMDb.
So he did the opening. What if the Americans get the next game? After 2012,
yeah.
if they get the
George
one
Lucas,
that, how about
George Lucas?
I was thinking Wes Craven.
No, but the thing I'm really looking forward to is that because we've got the Olympics in 2012.
Well, so
Mike Lee. I want Mike Lee to design the opening for the 2012 Olympics.
Well,
I want it to be a bunch of people sitting around in bedsits going, "Oh, blimey, this tea's a bit cold."
Your suggestions as for movie directors who could direct the opening then for 2012 will be gratefully received. At 7, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging.
Well, it's perfectly fine. I mean, I like Gurinder Chadha enough. I don't think it's as good a movie as Bend It Like Beckham, but it's a good, solid comedy for 12-year-olds and up. It is a 12-certificate movie, and I have more to say on the subject of that when we get to The Dark Knight, but 12 means 12, people.
Sing is King at 6.
An Oz-Indian comedy with Om Puri, which, again, I haven't seen. I've been away, about a Punjabi villager who becomes the king of the Australian underworld, apparently. Sounds nuts.
Make it happen at five.
Again, been away, an uninspired, dull dance flicker. Listen, I've been on holiday. What do you want me to do?
Go see movies like everyone else does. Wall-E at four.
Liked it very much. I've been saying to everybody who likes Wall-E, please go and rent Silent Running. And in fact, I think, aren't you and me going to show Silent Running at a cinema somewhere? We're going to do a special screening of it at some point.
It's a big secret which needs a big launch, not just to be leaked and dribbled out like you've just done.
Well, I haven't said anything about
it. Stand by for the big announcement.
Anyway, Silent Running is a wonderful film that you need to go and see, as well as Wall-E.
Mamma Mia's at three.
The women in my family went to see Mamma Mia, and because I had such a sort of rant about it, but I said it was incredibly good fun. They went to see it in Redruth in Cornwall, and they said that at the moment that Piers Brosnan started singing, the entire audience as one burst out laughing. And I like to hope that perhaps you and I were the push in that direction, that they all needed to understand that it's perfectly all right to laugh at Piers Brosnan, but still be enjoying the wonderful terribleness that is Mamma Mia. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen any of these.
Been packing them out in cinemas all around the country, and I'm so pleased because I'm sure it's put a smile on so many people's face. It is the film that's so awful, it's brilliant, and I encourage everybody to go and see it, not once, but twice.
I know that ABBA have been back at number one in the album charts, all off the back of Mamma Mia. I have to say, the greatest hits is slightly better than buying the soundtrack, even though the soundtrack is an interesting souvenir of the movie. The Dark Knight's at two.
All I want to say about this is, in my absence, there was a big news story with a lot of people writing in to complain to the BBFC for giving the Dark Knight 12 certificate. And the way their complaints went was usually this: I took my 8-year-old to see the Dark Knight and they were really upset. I don't think this movie is suitable for 10-year-olds. I took my 11-year-old to go see it. You know what? It's a 12. It's a 12 certificate, and the clue's in the number there. What the BBFC think is that the film is suitable for 12-year-olds and up. And there's a big notice at the beginning of the film that says, it's a 12 certificate movie. If you're bringing somebody under the age of 12 to see it, it's your responsibility. I cannot believe the amount of rubbish that's been written in the papers allowing parents to complain about taking under 12s to see The Dark Knight and then being surprised when it upsets them. It's a 12. That's the way it works. A 12 certificate means take a running guess at this. You probably should be 12 in order to see it.
Just make a note of that. If it's a 12... make sure you're 12.
And if you take someone who's not 12 to see it, it's your responsibility. There's a sign at the beginning of the movie that says the accompanying parent takes responsibility for it.
Right, now be brief on this number, because we've got an important race coming. The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, is the UK's number one.
I haven't seen it. You said be brief, there you go.
Okay, make something up.
No, I heard Andrew Collins say, he said something very funny. He said, who would have thought it? Brendan Fraser stars in a special effects heavy period adventure comedy suitable for children.
Which movie director should be responsible for opening 2012? Because, of course, there was a Chinese director who did the launch here. Jez says Guy Ritchie to direct the opening ceremony
with a
segment where all former Olympic drug cheats get their heads smashed in car doors. David says, get the guy who directed Trainspotting in 28 Days Later.
Danny Boyle,
to do the opening ceremony for London. Drugged up zombies running riot would be quite funny.
Excellent.
And this is quite good. Ken Loach should direct 2012. We could be sure of true British feeling and definitely wouldn't be any mime.
I don't want Ken Loach. I want Ken Russell. I want Ken Russell to direct it. I mean, imagine if Ken Russell did it. You'd have the entire Olympics dressed as, you know, weird psychotic nuns. It would be fantastic.
Chris in Newcastle is suggesting Terry Gilliam, which is a fine idea, but also given the amount of CGI which has since emerged, Hamish says, why don't we ask Nick Park to take charge for 2012? Anyway, let's get a movie underway. Let's do Star Wars.
Okay, now I know that...
Your favourite topic.
Like so many people, Simon, you were wondering about that line in Star Wars in which somebody refers to the Clone Wars. I have the line in front of me. It says, apparently Luke says, you fought in the Clone Wars, and Obi-Wan says, yes, I was once a Jedi Knight, the same as your father. And Luke says, I wish I'd known him. And apparently this has provoked a massive interest in the Clone Wars. So now we have Star Wars The Clone Wars, which is the first animated feature from the new Lucasfilm Animation. I mean, basically, what George Lucas has done is what he's always been wanting to do. He's dispensed totally with actors. You never really liked working with actors at all. I mean, you know, flesh and blood always sort of got in the way of all the special effects. So, we now have Star Wars The Clone Wars, which has, I mean, as far as the plot is concerned, as usual, it begins off that there is a thing which says, in the third quadrant of the blingy blong, when the tax of the what's it and the hooge, and you think, oh, I can't, I've done
this. Zoned out at that point.
No, but. So they have no plot to speak of, except, you know, it's a Clone Wars. There's loads of people fighting. Jabba the Hutt gets his son taken away, and then the Jedi have to go and get the son back because somebody else is pretending that... Anyway, completely incomprehensible balderdash. But the thing they don't have anymore is they don't have the returning stars. However, because they don't have the returning stars in their bodies, they don't have the returning stars in their voices, so what they've had to do is to get people to do impressions of the return of the animated returning stars, which for me was the most interesting thing about the Clone Wars, because you've now got... Matt Lanter and James Arnold Taylor, who they... Well, apparently, James Arnold Taylor, according to his website, is somebody who's wanted to be a voiceover artiste. You know, I have to understand that this particular Star Wars movie is not for me. Incidentally, it's a certificate. It's a Star Wars The Clone Wars, PG, and God bless the BBFC, PG for it contains frequent mild fantasy violence and the vague suggestion of sexualized dancing in an animated Star Wars movie, which probably is worth watching. Anyway, but the whole point of it is, right, they can't get the stars back to do it because presumably Ewan McGregor is too busy going around the world backwards on a bike with John Borman's son. Everybody else has got other stuff to do. What's his name? Anakin Skywalker. Hayden Christensen has gone off and played that character in that movie that isn't Bob Dylan, even though Dib Bobden thought it was him. So they've got in these other people. Now, I want you to listen to this because this is a clip. This is because the standard, you know, George Lucas executive producer, he didn't direct this, executive produced movie of people sort of discussing the actions that's going on, explaining the plot that's going on because nobody understands. But the majesty of this is this guy, this voiceover artist. And essentially what he's doing is, he's doing an impression of Ewan McGregor, who's a Scotsman, doing an impression of, you know, the original Obi-Wan Kenobi, who, of course, was famously a Londoner, doing an impression of what that might have sounded like several years beforehand. And listen to the beautiful way in which he implies all three of those characters in one.
Master Yoda, we are trapped here and vastly outnumbered. We are in no position to go anywhere or do anything. Our support ships have all been destroyed.
Send reinforcements to you. We will.
Master Yoda. Master Yoda!
We've lost the transmission, sir. We have to leave orbit immediately. More enemy ships have just arrived.
We'll get back to you as soon as we can.
I guess we'll have to hold out a little longer.
My apologies, young one. It's time for a proper introduction.
I'm the new Padawan learner. I'm Ahsoka Tano.
I am Obi-Wan Kenobi, your new master.
I'm at your service, Master Kenobi, but I'm afraid I've actually been assigned to Master Skywalker.
What? No. There must be some mistake. He's the one who wanted the Padawan.
No. Master Yoda was very specific. I'm assigned to Anakin Skywalker, and he is to supervise my Jedi training.
You can't help but be impressed by the brilliance of that performance, can you? I am Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'm not sure if my voice is coming from Edinburgh or somewhere down south, maybe a little bit American, but I'm completely surrounded by people who have learned to speak English from Mary Poppins. That bit where he says, God, blimey, we're completely cut off. We're never going to get out of here with those rebel troops all over the place. Blimey, Charlie, let's stick the readies in the boot and do a run. And the whole film is like that. However, majestically, they have managed to get Christopher Lee to do Count Dooku because, you know, Christopher Lee apparently was available, which, of course, is mad because the one person you don't need to do Christopher Lee is Christopher Lee because absolutely everybody can do Christopher Lee. I mean, I can do Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee goes, I am Christopher Lee. Hello, I have only ever made three horror movies. I'm actually a trained Shakespearean actor. Did you know I do opera? I can sing I Was Born...
We didn't want him to come back anyway because I thought Count Dooku was stupid.
Yeah, Count Dooku is a boring character, but Christopher Lee brings the majesty that is Count Dooku fantastically to life in this anime. The very fact that he turned up to do it kind of says something. And then, of course, you also get Samuel Jackson, who does about three or four lines as Mace Windu. Mace Windu, who is like, I never understood why Mace Windu is there. All he does is stands around, says a couple of boring things, and then goes away. And then Anthony Daniels turns up. But basically, the most starry performance is that of Christopher Lee as Count Dooku. Dooku. And that's pretty much the only selling point of the movie. And it's incoherent and it's all over the place and the animation is fairly poor and the story is complete nonsense and people run around shooting robots and lots of things get decapitated, but they're all robots so it doesn't upset the BBFC. And you just think, George, have you not got a big enough house? Have you not got more swimming pools than you can possibly swim in? Have you not got more cars and more property? Can you not do something other than just squeeze the last remaining drops of money out of this franchise? Now, I have no doubt that there will be young boys who will go and see the Clone Wars because you know, Star Wars completists and all the rest of it, and it's obviously aimed at a much younger audience, an even younger audience. And I have to say, it's actually not as bad as The Phantom Menace because it's not as long. But come, I mean, is it just me? Or doesn't everybody else think, come on, George, it's time to stop now?
It'll be number one next week.
It will, Mark, yeah. So, it will. Yeah,
the most overwhelming comment so far based on that little clip of Obi-Wan Kenobi that you played is that it sounds like William Hague. What do you reckon?
I don't think it sounds like anyone from the planet Earth.
Hague is Obi-Wan Kenobi, it's official.
That I would pay to see. Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, the new movie by Guillermo del Toro, which opens in the UK on Wednesday, which is why we're reviewing it now, because the next one's up to Friday. You know, my whole thing with Guillermo del Toro is I genuinely do think that he is the new Orson Welles. I think he's the man who's demonstrated that he can handle, you know, fantasy and realism with equal aplomb. And what he said for a long time was he's a Mexican director and he worked in Mexico, Spanish language director. And he said that what he wanted to do was to make one film for him and one film for Hollywood. So, for example, he would make something like The Devil's Backbone, which is about the Spanish Civil War. And then he would make, one of the Blade movies. He'd make Blade 2. And he once had a terrible experience with an American studio in that he made Mimic for Miramax. And other than that, he said that all his movies, even the ones that he's made for the Americans, he feels that they're sort of his films, but they are basically made as crowd pleasers. And then in the middle of this sort of strange European-American arrangement that he has the Hellboy movies, which are basically great big superhero American blockbusters, but I think are pretty much as close to being Guillermo del Toro movies as some of his best work, like, for example, Pan's Labyrinth. So the first Hellboy movie, which I absolutely love, which starred Ron Perlman, was not perhaps as widely seen as it should have been, although it was fantastically inventive and visually really wonderful film. Now comes Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. The poster for it is a picture of Ron Perlman, which I imagine everybody has now seen because they've plastered posters all over the tubes and things. And it's a huge picture of Ron Perlman in character as Hellboy. Basically, he looked like a tandoori chicken with these horns that he's sanded down. I mean, the deal is that he's this strange, monstrous creation, but he is working for the humans. He's working for the good guys. He's working for this special organization which are put together to combat the dark forces. And the tagline of the movie is, believe it or not, he's the good guy. And I kind of figure that everybody understood that the whole point about the Hellboy movies is that the monsters are the good guys. But apparently not everyone knows that. And so people who don't know the Hellboy franchise, that's the deal. The deal is he's the good guy. Here is a very brief clip which demonstrates what I think is the thing going on at the center of the Hellboy movies, which is although they're films about monsters, although they're films with huge, big supernatural battles and extravagant special effects and wonderful invention, they are, in the end, films about relationships, films about people, films about characters getting on with each other. And here is Hellboy going into a very difficult situation whilst having a romantic entanglement with his better half. Here we go.
Whatever they called us for is over. We had over 70 guests reported. We have no survivors, no bodies.
Same story here, babe.
Don't call me babe.
Hey, I said. Hey.
Drop channel.
Hey, I think Liz is still mad at me.
Still the same channel.
Oh.
Hello, are you there? Fine.
I'm here. Are you there?
I'm sorry. Just as that clip came to an end, a voice in my head said something. Anyway, never mind. Now, that to me is what the Hellboy movies are about. They're about characters. They're not, you know, about special effects. But they being Guillermo del Toro films, they have this incredible visual invention. I mean, I know that I kept saying to everybody that Pan's Labyrinth was the greatest movie of the year, and I still think that it's absolutely Guillermo's masterpiece. And there was a thing in Time Out recently in which he talked about his favourite films, and he said that Pan's Labyrinth was his favourite, and then he thought Devil's Backbone after that, and then Hellboy 2. I think Hellboy 2 deserves to be a great big mainstream hit. I mean, the joy of what he does is he takes fantastic situations, Chucky puts them on screen in a way which is genuinely visually inventive. I mean, compare this to the Clone Wars. I mean, the whole Lucas franchise seemed to be so bereft of any kind of visual inspiration. I mean, Lucas knows what the Star Wars universe looks like, apparently. The animators have decided that all these people now have got, you know, square chins and funny hair, and they just don't have any wit or invention about the way in which they visualize these things. Guillermo, on the other hand, is somebody who goes away and looks at paintings and looks at, you know, the Goya and looks at, you know, architecture, and that's where he gets his inspiration from. And consequently, you look at a film like Hellboy 2, which is, to all intents and purposes, a great big budget, stupid Hollywood superhero blockbuster, and it's intelligent and insightful and funny and inventive and genuinely exciting. And what I really hope of Hellboy 2 is that it becomes a huge mainstream hit, because it is him essentially working in the mainstream area. And that all the Guillermo del Toro fans go and see it alongside Pan's Labyrinth. You don't have to feel, I like Pan's Labyrinth, now I'm going to wait for the next Spanish language film. You can go and see Hellboy and enjoy it with a clear conscience, because it is as much a Guillermo movie as Pan's Labyrinth is.
Thanks for your 2012 movie director suggestions. Phil in Romsey, I'd have wanted David Lean, but you'd need a bigger stadium. Gary says, Ridley Scott would make a good Olympic opening, but we'd need to see it again uncut in 2016 and have it digitally remastered for 2020. Nigel on this says, Dear Simon, fellow Olympic holidaymakers, and Mark not invited, Kermode. On the topic of false noses, there was a famous Danish astronomer called, and I think this is Tycho Brahe, who wore a false nose after losing the original in a drunken duel. It was made of silver and gold, but he also used a copper one, presumably for less formal occasions. Not sure he's much of an athlete, but you can put him down as a second-rate fencer, if you like. Paul Greengrass to direct 2012. Thought you might like that one, Mark, but the TV coverage might come out all a bit blurry, according to Chris. Not a bad idea, though.
It would feature an excellent chase through Waterloo Station, and that would be really the thing that kicks out. We've got an email here from Neil Young. Now, he kind of shot himself in the foot.
A new friend.
Yeah, not that Neil Young. Neil Young from Sunderland, who also is our new friend. He was too clever for his own good. He sent the first email, which said, in the spirit of a Z and two noughts, Peter Greenaway could direct the Olympic ceremony, and it would then be called a 2, a 1, a 1 and a 2. And they had to then send a corrective email saying, what I meant was a 2, a naught, a 1 and a 2.
Thank you for explaining. So there's lots of crossbow and loads of stuff coming in, but let's finish off the movies, because this is our final chunk before the 10,000 metres. While the Polish national anthem plays.
I feel it's disrespectful to review You Don't Mess With the Zohan whilst the Polish national anthem is playing in the background, but, you know, with a movie like Mess With the Zohan...
To compensate it, I'll stand up.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm standing for Polish national anthem and you do the review.
Shall I stand up as well?
Yes, please.
Okay, I am now standing up as well. So, You Don't Mess With the Zohan. The story is Adam Sandler is a Mossad hitman in Israel who is tired of wiping out Palestinian terrorists, so flees Israel for America to pursue his dream of becoming a hairdresser, but ends up working for and falling in love with a Palestinian. Yes, it's exactly what you want. It's an Adam Sandler comedy about the difficult situation in the Middle East, which has been addressed by so many other movies in the past. But the thing we can say about it is funnier than Steven Spielberg's Munich. Here's a clip.
A big part of our job here is making this a fun experience.
Of course, of course.
For a lot of kids, this is their first haircut, and it can be very frightening for them.
I can imagine.
I don't want a haircut! Get away from me! Let me go!
Young man, look what I found here. A nice balloon. Do you want it? It's right here. You know, you shouldn't jump around when this nice woman's holding a sharp pair of scissors. If you move, she could slip and slice your jugular vein on accident. There's no way to stitch the jugular. All of your blood will be on the floor in 4 minutes. I've seen this. I've done this. You don't want this.
Adam Sandler was asked on a television program whether he said he wrote this script a long time ago. It's co-written by Judd Apatow, which just goes further to prove my thesis that Judd Apatow is not actually the new Messiah. But he said that the idea had been around for a while, and he was asked whether he had released the movie now because he felt that now was politically the correct time. And he said, I don't think it will ever be politically the correct time to release this movie. And it is true that you sit there watching the film at some point thinking, I can't quite believe that I am watching Adam Sandler as a Mossad terrorist playing a hairdresser working in a Palestinian hair salon, being pursued by John Turturro as a Palestinian assassin who has now opened a kebab shop. However, in its political defence, its general message is, you know what, we should all be nicer to each other, and if we all just put those grudges behind us, everything would work out a lot better, and we could all just enjoy the hummus and the fizzy bubblech, which is a fizzy drink which features very big in the movie and has become the source of some debate in internet circles, because the movie suggests that actually anyone from the Middle East will be absolutely thrilled if you open up a bottle of fizzy bubblech, and the question is whether or not fizzy bubblech actually exists or whether Adam Sandler has made it up. And in order to check this out, I went online to see whether... And there are indeed many fizzy bubblech products available, but I suspect that actually they are an offshoot of the movie, because other people who know more about this say that, in fact, it just sounds like something that he's made up, and in fact, there never was such a thing as fizzy bubblech. But it sort of demonstrates the problem with the film that I ended up wondering whether it was a real fizzy drink, because as with all Adam Sandler comedies, it starts out perfectly... You know, you think, OK, maybe he'll get away with this and maybe it'll be funny, but very quickly it just downshifts into the, oh, it's the old Adam Sandler jokes, it's the doing the funny accent that's not that funny, it's the doing the thing about the hairy underpants which is not that funny, and he's kind of running out of steam, but every now and then there'll be a little chortle, a little giggle, something to just sort of bounce you on. So it's nothing like the worst of Adam Sandler's films, it's nothing like the best of Adam Sandler's films, which as we know is Punch Drunk Love, and I still think he's never going to do anything as good as that again, and it is just for the fact that it exists and just for the fact that they have actually had the gall to make a movie which is so profoundly unpolitically correct, at least on the outside, and yet when you see it, it's so fantastically innocuous and so fantastically not offensive, and actually kind of a bit scared of its subject matter and not doing anything dangerous but playing it incredibly safe. So it's 90 minutes of ho-hum with a couple of chortles and no political offence, and the message is, we are the world, we are the children.
Yes, and I'd like to buy the world a Coke. The women in front of me...
I'd like to buy the world a fizzy bubbly.
Which will do. Actually, you know, Coke is one of the official drinks here, and one of the most... Yes, it's one of the official drinks, and Snickers is one of the official snacks, and Visa is the official card of choice. And you do get the feeling that almost the most offensive thing that you could say here in Beijing is not free Tibet, but can I use my MasterCard to buy a Pepsi? And if you shouted that loud enough, you get carted off by someone in an Olympics T-shirt. And I'm almost tempted to do that just before we finish. Bob in Hammersmith, I've yet to see the good Doctor's Del Toro admiration. Hellboy is laconic wit, big CGI set piece, cigar chomp, CGI set piece, sarcastic aside, followed by, yes, you've guessed it, CGI set piece. And Hellboy 2, fairies with teeth. Where have we seen that? Oh, Pan's Labyrinth, he says. What a visionary director he is. I think there's some sarcasm in that.
Yeah, I know. The funny thing is, in the review in The Guardian today, Pete Bradshaw used that word visionary. And he said that actually Hellboy 2 is what he said. People overuse the word visionary, and Hellboy 2 is one of the few movies in which it can be used properly, because he said, you know, Guillermo is genuinely a director of vision. And he also had the courage to point out that when he'd seen Pan's Labyrinth, he, unlike everybody else, hadn't really liked it very much, but he had really, really been taken by Hellboy 2 because what it had is a sense of humour. I mean, I never understand anybody who doesn't get Pan's Labyrinth, but it was just interesting that a major upmarket newspaper in the critic writing who didn't like Pan's Labyrinth actually embraced Hellboy 2 and said, you know, it is a genuinely visionary work and gave it 4 stars. I mean, I have yet to see Guillermo put a foot wrong. Of course, the film that he made that doesn't work is Mimic, and it's not his fault, it's Miramax's fault, because they took the film away from him and got other people to finish it. Other than that, I think he's got a pretty much flawless track record, so wrong as wrong can be.
David in Brig, John Borman to do the Olympic ceremony, as he is great at dull, pointless and expensive
things.
Yes,
very good, very good.
Sid in Middlesbrough, how about Terry Jones as director? These are all suggestions for director for 2012, following the Chinese success with Zhang Limu. Terry Jones as director, he could make the equestrians use coconut shells.
How did Zhang Limu? When did the L come from?
Zhang Yimu.
Yeah, you said Limu.
No, I don't think
you did. And Limu was the lead singer of Kajagoogoo.
No, that was Limahl.
Oh, him, yeah.
Mark, we've got time for you to wrap up in a splendid and entertaining way, if you wouldn't mind.
OK, so shall I very quickly do Wild Child?
Do Wild Child. Is that your big finale?
Yeah, well...
Your big showpiece, closing ceremony?
It will be it. OK, so Wild Child. So the best thing you can say about Wild Child is that it isn't St Trinian's, although it desperately wants to be St Trinian's, and it's written by Lucy Dahl, who's the daughter of Roald, and therefore I imagine the sister of, you know, the other one who came on the programme and also writes... So the story is a spoilt Yankee American schoolgirl is sent to England to go to a strict boarding school by her dad, who thinks that it'll sort her out. And she comes to England, and she comes to that version of England that only Americans ever come to, in which, you know, everyone appears to live in some strangely anachronistic boarding school, and they go up and down Golden Hill every now and then, and they have sort of girly talks about how they're going to sort everything out. But the difficult thing is that she wants to be expelled from the school, and we're all kind of quite hoping she does. But the thing that convinces her to stay is that she falls in love with Alex Pettifer. And do you remember Alex Pettifer came on the show? Remember Alex Pettifer used to be the lead, he was the lead guy in Stormbreaker.
Oh yes, I do.
Alex Pettifer.
He's turned up again. I thought he disappeared.
Yeah, well, me too. I was the only person in the world who, you know, sort of, you know, wholeheartedly embraced Stormbreaker. In fact, I was just in the Isle of Man last week, and I was on Port Erin Beach, which is where they filmed.
We all embraced Stormbreaker. I'm not sure that he was a particularly fantastic.
Have you got time to hear a little bit of his acting?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, here we go.
There's 24 laps to go on.
Here we go. Here we go. Alex Pettifer, who, you know, he sort of made his debut in Stormbreaker, now back as the smushy hunk in Wild
smushy?
Child. Yeah, you know, they want to smush with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go, Trouble.
Bread and fries. That's my treat.
If I affect your life in no other way, allow me this honour. The humble chip butty.
Here we go.
Kind of gross, but I like it.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the best days ever. The best day I've ever had.
Something about you, Poppy Moon. Every moment I'm with you, I catch my breath.
So as you can see, he hasn't actually got massively better than he was. I mean, it's a funny thing, because when he was in Stormbreaker, he was kind of cute. And I like Stormbreaker, and I thought it, you know, it did the job fine, although Mickey Rourke was rubbish in it. But Alex Pettifer...
Mickey Rourke is usually rubbish.
No, and Mickey... Well, I don't know. You know, we could have a talk for ages about whether Mickey Rourke is always rubbish. I think Mickey Rourke has done some very good very early on in his career.
Usually.
Yeah, no, but I think he is not well-liked, is the fact. But Alex Pettifer, it is... The absolute, you know, it's the wooden performance of the year award so far. All he has to do is swan around being handsome. That's it. You know, she's been sent from America to a girls' boarding school, and all Alex Pettifer has to do is walk in and out with a square jaw and every now and then sound a bit toffee-nosed and be the British hunk that she can fall for. And he does it really badly, and it's really odd, because the one thing about Alex Pettifer is he's kind of a handsome young man. And yet, in this, it appears that he can't actually even do that. And I can't quite figure out what happened from the fairly promising, you know, well, he was handsome, but maybe he's going to be more than that, to in this, when you go, not even that anymore. And the problem with the film is, it, you know, as I said, it wants to be St Trinian's and it doesn't want to be St Trinian's, and it kind of isn't St Trinian's. It's a 12 certificate, and it's aimed at a sort of semi-young audience, but it's got just enough un-young stuff in it to push it up to the 12, and there's some moderate sex references, and there's, you know, some language, which
is there any sexualised dancing?
There isn't any. No, don't get me wrong, because George Lucas will jump up and down your head about it. There is the vague suggestion of sexualised dancing in the animated Star Wars movie. There isn't actually any sexualised dancing in it. It's just vaguely suggested. It means it's in silhouette.
Okay,
so,
right.
So again,
it's blissfully clear.
Thank you. So classic problem. You're a 12-year-old girl, right? Well, you're not a 12-year-old girl. Neither am I. But one is a 12-year-old girl, and you're going, where are the movies that make it worth my while going to the cinema? Outside of Mamma Mia, which incidentally turns out is a massive hit with the 12-year-old girl market, if you were a 12-year-old girl, where are the great movies? And I think the answer is, they've gone. And I'm really, outside of Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging, which is the closest thing you've got to an absolutely spot-on movie in that market this summer, it's just a great, big, barren, empty hole. I think if I was a 12-year-old girl, I would be up in arms about how badly served I was by the cinema industry.
Let's wrap up then with Mark. The listener's choice, Mark, as far as the director for 2012...
Yes.
...following on from Zhang Yimou...
Ken Russell.
...who did it all here.
Ken Russell.
Well, no, it's either... Terry Gilliam,
yep.
Nick Park, or Ridley Scott. They seem to be out in front. Although this John from John in Manchester, Russ Mayer to direct London.
Oh, no. Can I just say officially?
What would happen then?
Of women running around with, you know, with ample bosom, as it's described
in
that film.
That's the women's 10,000 metres, I think.
Right, I just like to anyway, say you made that joke, not me. And can I just say, on the subject of the guy dressed as Batman on the M2, I thought he was campaigning about the 12 certificate, but apparently it's something completely not to do with that.
Movie of the week.
Well, clearly the Guillermo del Toro, you know, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, opens on Wednesday, but it's already the movie of the week. And, you know, it's won the 12A certificate, incidentally. 12A certificate, and as we said before with the Batman film, 12A certificate means don't take people under the age of 12. And if you do, don't complain when they get freaked out by the fairies with teeth, because the teeth fairies in that movie, the tooth fairies, are scary.
Mark, thank you. I will see you in person next Friday.
Thank you.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.